The next speaker is Vince Warren.
Thanks, Michael. And thank you all for coming. I wanted to talk a little bit and pick up on some of the themes that John had mentioned, to talk a little bit about how this theory of the unitary president plays out and has played out over the last 5 years in various portions. And I think John pointed out very well in bringing together the two strands of the conservatives and the right that underlie why it is so radical, and culminating with the idea that power is as power does. I think that in thinking about how they have implemented this power in the post 9/11 context, that the mechanism has been one in which that the law now is as power does, which in a sense really does encapsulate what it means to be a police state. We have here, I want to talk about four main issues. One is the creation of perpetual war that underlies a lot of the mechanisms that have been put in, all of the mechanisms that have been put into place post 9/11. I want to talk about the mechanism of bringing in through Congress, a broad grant of presidential authority to do whatever it is that he wishes to do, and how that has flown into two basic fights that the Center for Constitutional Rights, Amnesty International, and other groups have been fighting for the last 5 years to restore democracy. One is the elimination of basic rights that belong to the people, that belong to people, whether they are American citizens, non-citizens, or detainees, or suspected terrorists, even actual terrorists themselves. And the idea of how to maintain the stripping of those rights by eliminating the jurisdiction of courts or other parts of the government or the people to be able to criticize and to shed light on what those problems are. This is, as John and Michael both pointed out, this is not new, what we're talking about here, but the flavor is new. The opportunity, I think John is correct, is one that's been created, and it has given the radicals that are in authority now a golden opportunity to roll back rights, to solidify, to create an expansive, illegal expansion of presidential power, and to solidify power in essentially one person, in one man. And I think it's key that it is a man that this is solidified in. It flows into a number of issues, including the suppression of dissent, the eradication of privacy, the elimination of habeas corpus, the commodification and actualization of torture, including secret facilities and things like that. It's always helpful to go back to the basic document that some of this stuff flows from. And I think in the post 9/11 context, in my view, that a lot of the Bush administration work here has flown from the authorization for use of military force, which was passed with one dissenting vote in the Congress 7 days after September 11th on September 18th, 2001. The authorization for the use of the military force, which I'll just call the authorization for the purpose of these comments, authorized the presidents to use all necessary and appropriate force against the nations, organizations, or persons that he determines planned or authorized or committed the September 11th attacks. It is also put into place to give the president the authority, and this is where we get into the preemption discussion, to prevent future acts of international terrorism. It's not necessarily international terrorism that affects this country in terms of its citizens, but certainly in the way that the global economy is set up, that the theory that international terrorism anywhere is terrorism that affects United States financial interests, and that and President Bush wanted the ability to act unilaterally and preemptively, in his view, as he saw fit, to eliminate the risk of those types of attacks. This authorization has really been key in how the Bush administration has at least argued to deal with two main issues that have presented themselves in the post 9/11 context. One is the issue of wiretapping and spying, and the other one is in the issue of the treatment of the Guantanamo detainees. In the wiretap context, that the Bush administration has said that this authorization of power has authorized them to wiretap American citizens domestically, where the president feels that there might be a link, or a link to a link to terrorism, or a link to someone who has supported terrorism, even though that the wiretapping mechanism that the Bush administration puts into place contravenes established U.S. law, most specifically the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. In court, when I believe this was the Center for Constitutional Rights has a NSA wiretapping case, as does the ACLU. In the context of the ACLU case, the government raised the argument that this authorization allowed the president to wiretap regardless of what previous federal law said. In the decision that was that came down by Anna Diggs Taylor in Detroit, she smacked that decision down and said in very clear terms that the administration authorization, while it did grant authority for some things, did not give President Bush the ability to wiretap U.S. citizens indiscriminately. She ruled that the wiretapping program was unconstitutional. That has been appealed and has been recently argued in the Sixth Circuit, which is the federal circuit that deals with that part of the country. Also, in the context of the military commissions, military commissions are these show trials that the Bush administration has decided to slap up because they realize that they have held up to 700 people in indefinite detention in Guantanamo. And I should point out here that the Center for Constitutional Rights, which was the first organization to file a habeas corpus petition on behalf of Guantanamo detainees, it was filed 20 days after the first detainees were brought to Guantanamo. They were brought in January of 2002, and the center filed their first habeas corpus petition in February of 2002. The Bush administration has taken the position, of course, as you all know, that the president can decide who is an enemy combatant. The president can pick up anybody in the world that he would like and can send this person to a series of facilities and essentially detain them any place in the world. All of the places where these folks are being detained are offshore. These are the sort of the network of offshore prison colonies, one of which, of course, is the facility at Guantanamo Base. And there have been several, and I believe still exist, several what people call ghost detention facilities or black sites around the world that the United States has entered into agreements with foreign governments that have a financial stake on the American gravy train to be able to detain these folks and do serious, torturous interrogations for intelligence purposes. And this is one of the things that happened to Meher Arar, who was also a Center for Constitutional Rights client. And I know one person was asking about information about him, and you can find out about Meher Arar by visiting our website, which is www.ccr-ny.org. In the context of the military commissions, there was a decision that the Supreme Court came out with last year, the Hamdan decision, which the center and other groups were deeply involved in. And among the wonderful decisions, the issues that were decided by the court and decided correctly, interestingly enough, was that the military commission were not authorized by this presidential authority. And so what you have here is the notion that George Bush, as a president in whom all authority to protect the national interest must be consolidated, has been getting a series of pushbacks, at least from some members of the judiciary, and certainly from, you know, what Arthur Kanoy, founder of CCR, and my constitutional law professor calls the fourth branch of government, which is the people. The people and the judiciary have, I think, reacted against the Bush administration plans, but for two very different reasons. Well, actually, they're really the same reason. And the idea is that the power that is invested in both the people and the power that is invested in the judiciary, at least through the Constitution, has been stripped by this activity. The fallacy, I think, in our form of government is that the people, meaning us, that we only have the ability, especially in terms of how the radical right sees it, to vindicate and protect and advance our interests only really through the three branches of government that are all conspiring to try to get rid of them anyway. What we found, though, which very interestingly in this context, is that while George Bush can mess with the people and can spy on us and can throw us in jail and can repress political movements, and we can take to the streets and we can talk about it, he's finding out that it's very difficult to mess with the judiciary on this. I think this was a very key miscalculation on the part of the Bush administration, even having had 25 years of stacking the bench with ideologues for the most part. the authorization mirrors in great respects historical documents that we are all familiar with in our studies and our work. It's not dissimilar to the concept of Israeli administrative detention. It mirrors the internal security acts of Malaysia and Singapore, which, interestingly enough, the Bush the U.S. government has for years been calling on those governments to get rid of because it found that they were much too repressive. And I think it also mirrors the infamous state of emergencies during the South African struggle. In the latter days of the apartheid regime, that there were these series of states of emergency that was created by the Botha government, some regionally and some nationally, and the state of emergency would then allow any of the myriad of state police military forces to detain, arrest, beat, and assassinate political resistors. This is the type of mechanism that the Bush administration has initially started to deploy. And let's talk about then, even though as they've been pushed back by some members of the judiciary, let's just talk a little bit about what they are. You've all read, I'm assuming recently, the mea culpa by the administration about how the FBI has mistakenly, because of the database was wrong, had been spying on thousands of people and issued administrative subpoenas to obtain telephone and business and financial records without judicial approval of Americans. And of course, the way that the Bush administration characterizes that, as administrations have, mistakes were made. This is some sort of low-level person that we coded the database wrong, we're terribly sorry, and we're going to take responsibility to see that this never happens again. We all know that the entire point of having this type of spying, of creating databases, of creating watch lists, of seeking the presidential power to do this type of stuff, was so that this spying could happen. The problem is that they got caught. And, you know, while the mainstream press very rarely gets it right, and certainly the New York Times and the Washington Post among them, that they have been at least an ally in exposing the nature of these very secret programs that arguably, although I'm not inclined to believe it, that many in Congress don't really know about as well. But, you know, these FBI subpoenas or national security letters are really only to be used in espionage and terrorism cases, and only against people suspected of being agents of foreign power. And regardless of what you think of that paradigm, which is problematic in itself, we do know that the Patriot Act has expanded that power, and now it has been misused by this government. The government has taken the position that all we seek is the ability to do something, but trust us that we're going to exercise our judgment to do it and comport with the constitutional principles. Now, we know that this is not true. We have suspected for a while. I know that certainly the ACLU and CCR has been in touch with people on the ground that have spoken very seriously about how this is not true. But now the issue is out in the public, and the question is, what are we going to do about that? According to the government's, according to the independent report that was issued on these national security letters prior to 2001, that the government was able to issue these administrative subpoenas. And just to be clear, a subpoena is generally a document that a lawyer or a prosecutor has to go to court for. The court will review the basis for wanting the subpoena. The court will either grant or deny the subpoena based on the probable cause, the good information that the likelihood that the person that they're seeking is involved in the activity that the government is trying to do away with. Here we have administrative subpoenas that only need to be signed by the head of the prosecuting entity in a local place. There is no court involvement whatsoever. In 2000, these types of administrative, there were about 8,500 of these administrative subpoenas. That was before September 11th. In 2003, there were 39,000. In 2004, there were 56,000. In 2005, there were 47,000. There's another interesting issue that's sort of coming up on the spying program, which is that the FCC and the Justice Department have been working very feverishly to expand the communications vehicles that the government is now allowed to tap. We know that when you go way back to Operation Shamrock, which was, I think, in the 1960s it started and ended in the 70s, then the government was looking at telegrams, all telegrams coming in and out of the country. It's been expanded to telephone calls. It's been expanded to cell phone calls. It's been expanded to internet, reading your emails. And the latest thing that they're now trying to do is they're trying to expand this to internet phone calls. And for those of you who are like me that still have landlines in your house, landlines are telephones with lines on them as opposed to cell phones. But I think people who are more tech savvy and are now focusing on trying to do internet phone calls. They're much cheaper. They're clearer. You don't have to go through the huge corporations. But at least as I understand it, effective this May, that there's legislation that has been introduced that will require internet phone companies like Vonage, who have the most annoying commercials in the world, to make their internet telephone service wiretap ready. So they're now beginning to, they recognize as these technologies emerge that the government is ahead of the curve, and before you are being able to be licensed to do this type of stuff, you have to comply with our ability to tap into your system to monitor people. Going back to Operation Shamrock, this is a process that was done by monitoring the telegrams that was done by a predecessor to the National Security Agency. And that process stopped in the mid-1970s because Bella Abzug on the House side and Frank Church on the Senate side began to understand that there was mass surveillance stemming from the 60s movement, stemming from Vietnam and Cambodia protesters. And brought the heads of the National Security Agency to Congress to justify these actions. They suspended the program just before people were going to testify in Congress. And that tactic, by the way, is a tactic that the Bush administration employs today. Right before you get to court, the Bush administration changes the game. And this happened in two contexts. It happened in the context of Jose Padilla, who they said, we can hold him in the military context as long as we want. And just before they were brought to court to do that, they changed up and they transferred him into civilian context. And now he's in the civilian trial, literally, for his life, in which he had been tortured so badly that his lawyers made the plea to the court that he couldn't stand trial because of the nature of his torture has essentially made him insane and incompetent to stand trial. That was recently overruled. And the other context was in the context of the national security spying in the ACLU case. Just before the Sixth Circuit argument, Alberto Gonzalez comes out and says, well, even though we retain the power and we believe that we do have the power to wiretap illegally, we will now have this wiretapping go through the Foreign Intelligence Court. We also know that that is not a concession to due process nor to the people. They really do have a foreign intelligence judge. It's a very secret court. Nobody knows anything about it, but they have a judge in the pocket who says, yes, I'm just going to rubber stamp these subpoenas. But getting back to Frank Church, whose committee was looking at the NSA, there's an interesting quote from Frank Church that I think, looking at it now, 22 years later, it does really put in perspective, I think, even how mainstream forces looking at the illegal expansion of executive power can realize the danger. And the question for us is, and especially with politicians, people can talk in broad notions about police state and tyranny, but the question for us is, do they really recognize it when it's here? Frank Church says that the capability, in 1975, the capability to monitor domestic conversations within the United States at any time could be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy left. Such is the capability to monitor everything. Telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide. If this government ever became a tyranny, if a dictator ever took charge of this country, the technical capacity that the intelligence community has given the government could enable it to impose total tyranny, and there would be no way to fight back, because the most careful effort to combine together in resistance to the government, no matter how privately done, is within the reach of the government to know. And that is precisely where we are today. And the other interesting thing about this Vonage situation is, and it's really kind of strange, because one of my board members sent me an email over the weekend and said, you have to think about Skype. You know, you do this international, all of this international work. Rhonda Copeland. Yeah. You do all of this international work, and it's expensive. We're a nonprofit organization. You should look into internet phone calls. And it's, you know, what it does is that it, you should also realize that it's not just that this is another technology. This is a tool that is used by leftist organizations. This is used by us. This is how we communicate with each other. We've been able to organize much better, much more effectively through the internet. And these are precisely the mechanisms that the government is beginning to focus on. I do want to speak very briefly on the Military Commissions Act, which I think really does bring home the notion that there are rights that are being stripped from us and that the courts are being stripped of their ability to monitor that. The Military Commissions Act was passed by Congress in October of 2006. If you recall, 2006 was the fifth anniversary of September 11th. 5 days before September 11th, President Bush said, oh, by the way, we do have these secret facilities where we keep and torture and detain people, and we've been doing that for a while. Of course, he didn't say that they'd torture and detain them, but they do. And we're closing them down. That program has ended, right? Again, ending the program, and then you're waiting for the punchline. And the punchline is we're now transferring all of those folks to Guantanamo. We're going to transfer the 14 high-value detainees, the worst of the worst, and then turned around, came to New York, did the September 11th, 5th anniversary show, and then went back to Congress and said, now you have to pass the Military Commissions Act. And the Military Commissions Act is one of the most heinous acts that has been passed recently and quite literally divests us and us in the persons of the Guantanamo detainees, and us in the person of people that are suspected to be connected to terrorism in virtually any way, and us as people that are connected with leftist movements. It purports to end the constitutional relationship between our ability to coalesce, to challenge power, and it puts all of that authority in the president to determine how that's done. The Military Commissions Act, it's done a number of things, but key among them is that it attempts to undo the victories that the Center for Constitutional Rights and other groups have won actually at the Supreme Court level. The way this has worked is we represent the detainees, the lower courts mess up, we get to the Supreme Court says, you're right, the Geneva Conventions do apply to the detainees. Yes, you're right, the military commissions are a sham and that the president can't do that stuff militarily. And then it goes back to Congress, and Congress then changes everything. And what Congress did here is Congress has restricted the scope of what is torture under how the U.S. interprets the Geneva Conventions, such that the actions that the U.S. has done to torture and abusive interrogations in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, Afghanistan does not constitute torture. It is given immunity for government officials who have been involved in interrogations so that no detainee can challenge or sue or pursue their detainees or the government for what has been done to them. It has, of course, eliminated or seeks to eliminate the right of habeas corpus that has been with us since the 11th century, and that it strips the ability of detainees to be able to go into court to challenge the very nature, condition, or purpose of their detention. And if there is a founding notion in this country, that is that the king cannot detain you without you being able to at least ask why, and ask why publicly, and have the king explain. And that is quite literally the thing that is at this fight during this time. The other thing that the Military Commissions Act does that is also deeply troubling is that it codifies the notions of enemy combatants that the Bush administration has been trying to ram down our throats for 5 years. The idea that it is the president and the attorney general alone that get to determine who is an enemy combatant and allows them to pick that person up off of the street, either domestically in the United States or any place else in the world, and take them to a detention facility indefinitely. Finally, just to bring this full circle, let's talk about Guantanamo for 1 second. There are 395 people in Guantanamo. There were up to 700 people. According to the government's own estimates, 92% of the people in Guantanamo have no connection, affiliation with Al-Qaeda. So it raises the question, why are they there? And the reason why they are there is precisely for the reasons that that John had mentioned, that when you have these watch lists, when you have these lists, when you're spying on folks, that they don't contract, they really do expand. And the notion is that you end up being caught in this net, as Michael said, with Meher Arar, not because of what you do, not because of what you believe, but who you associate with, and not even why you associate with them. We have a manifestation of that problem in Guantanamo, which is why the Center for Constitutional Rights represents over 200 of those detainees. We can all be picked up off the street. There's no question about it, and we now have this codified in law. This is no longer a paranoid fantasy of the left. This is no longer our worst nightmare. This is no longer we have to be careful what we say over the phone. This is actuality now. We are at the point where the law now is as the president and power does. Thank you.
That was a very good job.
Shall we switch?
Ms. Warren, thank you very much. That was a terrific presentation. We're going to rebroadcast all this on Law and Disorder, and I'll give you the details at the end of this program.
Maybe not all of it. Maybe just select portions.
Yeah, we got an hour a week.
Yeah, we can put it on the website, too.
Absolutely, yeah. On the website.
Great.
Yeah. Okay, well, this is
yeah, we'll put it up on the website for sure. Lawanddisorder.org. Vince, good luck. Bring home the bacon.
So sorry.
Vince, your coffee. Okay, good morning.